This podcast is brought to you with limited interruption by Rudy Luther Toyota. Whether looking for an exciting brand new Toyota, a certified pre-owned vehicle, or getting quality routine maintenance and service for your vehicle, Rudy Luther Toyota is the place to go. Rudy Luther Toyota, the southeast corner of 394 and 169 in Golden Valley.
But not pre-recorded today. We are live on the Matt McNeil Show. It is not Matt McNeil, though. Brett Johnson here with you on a Tuesday afternoon, filling in for Matt as he takes some time off, hoping he'll be back in the hosting seat tomorrow, but you are stuck with Patrick and me today. Patrick, how are things in your world over there?
Pretty good. I was actually sitting here as that intro music was playing, and maybe I should have pulled up the old FYI intro. For those of you who don't watch on Facebook, it's always fun kind of watching Brett headbang to it a little bit. This was back in the old 2 p.m. Hour last year.
Yeah, it was a long intro. I mean, what else was I going to do for 25 seconds as that intro music played? So I can't really quite get the same head bob going with the Matt McNeil show theme, but we'll still roll with it here as Matt should be back tomorrow. And by the way, it is just going to be Patrick and me today, and your phone calls as well if you like, at 952-946-6205. Of course, normally I speak with Patrick Coulican on Tuesdays, but he's feeling a little under the weather this afternoon, so we'll be visiting with him hopefully on Friday. So yeah, open phone lines for the next 2 hours at 952-946-6205. 952-946-6205. I think I said open phone lines. That would be open phone lines. I think that would be something entirely different. All right, let's start off with the news today. And apparently, if you're a fan of beef, you might be in some trouble if you're trying to buy some meat products, as 20% of the U.S. beef capacity has been wiped out today due to a cyber attack that has affected all sorts of plants around the country and around the world, including the JBS plant that is located in Worthington, Minnesota, as IT servers for its U.S., Canada, and Australian operations were affected yesterday following an organized cyber attack, according to a news release by Greenlee-based JBS USA. There are reports of similar JBS plant shutdowns around the U.S. and Canada, including in Colorado, Texas, and Minnesota. Australia's meat processing industry was disrupted for the second straight day. It's crazy to think about 20% of the U.S. beef capacity has been wiped out due to a cyber attack. Really nothing to do with actually slaughtering the animals themselves or getting them on the assembly line or doing whatever else you need to do. I'm by no means any expert in terms of how you are able to get those meat products onto the shelves, but an IT server can apparently affect the entire or at least a large portion of the operational system. So that's just crazy to think about to me, Patrick, because I remember if we rewind back to March and April of 2020, how JBS and these other meat packing plants were saying, we desperately need to stay open and have our workers in, even though the COVID-19 pandemic has just begun and we really have no treatment or vaccine options available. We still need all of these workers in these plants to make these meat products. Otherwise, our entire capacity is going to shut down. Well, lo and behold, 20% capacity has been shut down due to an IT server error, and I'm not quite hearing the same kicking and screaming from the meat industry, including JBS. So just a little observation I'd point out right there. But that is still crazy just to think about how one little IT server can almost entirely shut down your beef capacity, even though, I don't know, if I would be someone who would be working on an assembly line or someone who's slaughtering animals, not saying I would be doing that, but I don't know if I would really be needing that IT server to be working, but I guess that's the way that big business works now. But 20% wiped out, all due to an IT hack. Now, unless, I don't know, maybe you can somehow hack these machines and maybe you get like the assembly line to cut off the wrong parts of the animals or something. I don't know how else that could work in terms of how an IT error could affect things. But the Worthington plant has been shut down at least through, I think, this afternoon, where they've had to send all of the workers home from their shifts. Sticking along the lines of talking about animals, I got to bring up this story right here from PETA. PETA wants the city of Ham Lake, Minnesota, to change its name to Yam Lake, and says it will help cover the costs of changing the city signs in its official agreement if it were to be signed. Really, we're going to be making a push to change. At least PETA is making a change from Ham Lake to Yam Lake. I can't think of anything more pointless to do from PETA's perspective. Oftentimes they're criticized, rightly so, for focusing on campaigns that don't really actually do anything for animals. And I think this certainly fits the bill of trying to change Ham Lake to Yam Lake.
This is not the first story I've heard about them suggesting that. Out in the state of New York, there is a town called Fishkill. And they had asked them if they would like to change that. And the name actually comes from a Dutch origin, which in the old Dutch language, kill means creek. So the name of the town was actually Fish Creek. It was not English, we're killing fish. It was named after the creek.
See, and this is why PETA has the reputation that it has right now, where for the most part, a lot of people don't take PETA seriously for issues like this. Whereas you're talking about, what was the name of that town again? Killfish?
Fishkill.
Or Fishkill. Yeah, where the word kill doesn't even have the meaning that they think it does, going back to the origins. And by the way, that doesn't really do anything to actually help fish by just changing the name of a town. Same idea with this Ham Lake idea. And of course, it just gives fodder to politicians up in the area, including Republican State Senator Michelle Benson, who tweeted out saying, maybe we should change the name to Steak Lake. Yeah, so you just fan the flames and PETA, yeah, trying to make that change from Ham Lake to Yam Lake. I very much doubt that would go anywhere, but it still just goes along the lines of why a lot of people don't take PETA seriously when you're doing things like these. Sticking along with more news of the day and something that I actually could kind of get behind in terms of renaming. This has to do with the name of a street in Minneapolis. So organizers and supporters of an online petition are aiming to change the name of Dight, D-I-G-H-T, Dight Avenue in Minneapolis, which is named after a eugenicist. The petition on change.org has reached more than 300 signatures as of today with a goal of 500. It states that the street name is harmful to people with disabilities and asks Mayor Jacob Frey and the Minneapolis City Council to change it. The street runs parallel to Hiawatha Avenue in the Howe neighborhood. Now, Dight Avenue is named for this guy, Charles Fremont Dight, who is described by the Minnesota Historical Society as Minnesota's most avid and consistent supporter of eugenics. He worked as a University of Minnesota professor and was elected to the Minneapolis City Council in 1914, all while leading a crusade to bring eugenics to Minnesota. In fact, Dight organized the Minnesota Eugenics Society in 1923 and began campaigning for a sterilization law. In 1925, the Minnesota legislature passed a law allowing sterilization of the feeble-minded and insane who were residents of the state's institutions. For the next several legislative sessions, Dight then fought unsuccessfully for the expansion of that sterilization law to include people who lived outside of institutions. So even by historical standards, yeah, this guy is a pretty lousy person. I often think when it comes to looking at whether we need to rename a street, a monument, or whatever else, that's an entirely different discussion as to whether you should rename those things. But if you are, let's at least make sure the people were actually bad people even for the period of their time. And I think this guy, Dight, definitely fits this bill as being a proponent of eugenics in Minnesota back in the early 20th century. And by the way, if that wasn't enough, in 1933, he wrote a letter to Adolf Hitler in which he voiced support for Hitler's intentions to stamp out mental inferiority in Germany. Hitler responded, thanking Dight and inviting him to a lecture in Munich, Germany. Unfortunately, Dight was never able to attend because he died in 1938. So if we're looking at even historical circumstances, yeah, this guy probably should not have a street named after him. A little bit different than what we're seeing up in Ham Lake, where, again, PETA wants to change that to Yam Lake. Sometimes got to judge these things by at least the historical perspective. One more local story to get to before we head to break. And this has to do with more misconduct from the Minneapolis Police Department. Department going back to last year. If you remember last summer, there was a journalist for CNN who was arrested live on TV. Omar Jimenez was the name of the reporter who was arrested live on the airwaves. Well, now a security officer who was working with CNN and I believe accompanying Jimenez back in Minneapolis last year is suing the city of Minneapolis for $500,000 as he was arrested along with Jimenez, held for over 20 hours. And in the lawsuit, he claims that basically every other white reporter that was around him were not being arrested. So I think he might have a pretty good chance of winning that $500,000 lawsuit. And Minneapolis probably going to have more and more of these coming when you consider the journalists that were assaulted last year, let alone the average ordinary folks. So $500,000, that could be your taxpayer money going to this CNN security guy suing the city because, well, they basically arrested him for no reason because he was a reporter while black. 952-946-6205, 952-946-6205. We'll come on back and have more news on the day with you here on The Matt McNeil Show. I was about to say old FYI politics. Patrick could even throw me off thinking I was hosting my own show. No, this is The Matt McNeil Show, but Brett Johnson filling in here on a Tuesday afternoon. Stick around, we got lots more.
Too close to you, but now it looks like I'm getting too close to you. My mom tries to catch me, but
AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. Brett Johnson and Patrick Lilia filling in for Matt McNeil on a Tuesday afternoon. Matt taking the day off. Hopefully we'll be back in the hosting chair tomorrow, as today just me and Patrick riffing on the news of the day. By the way, I got a text from a friend of mine who you may have heard on Friday co-hosting that last half hour with me, Mike, as he says, we could probably actually just change one letter in Ham Lake. Let's make it Ram Lake. And that would have an entirely different connotation. So I like that idea. 952-946-6205. 952-946-6205. Pete Stauber, who is the representative in Minnesota's 8th Congressional District, which includes a large portion of northern Minnesota, and is also on the U.S.-Canada border. He was at the border today. Only not the border you're thinking of. He was at the U.S.-Mexico border. I think he got a little confused on where his district is. Yeah, Patrick, I just can't figure that out, how a guy who represents a district which is on the U.S.-Canada border decided to go to the U.S.-Mexico border instead. And he wrote an op-ed in the Star Tribune today talking about his experience along the U.S.-Mexico border near the Rio Grande River. And largely what you would kind of expect. I'm not even going to really read many excerpts from it, except a few little parts which kind of caught my attention, including this right here. This is, again, from Representative Pete Stauber's op-ed in the Star Tribune. Biden and many of my Democratic colleagues in Congress would have you believe that their immigration policies are more compassionate than those of the previous administration. This could not be further than the truth. Now, Stauber's not necessarily wrong with that statement right there, maybe a little bit misleading, because we still are very much mistreating a lot of the immigrants that we have at our border right now. In fact, you can even look at the immigration policies we even had back during the Obama administration. They weren't exactly that nice either. So he's a little misleading, I would say, with that statement in terms of if you compare how Biden is treating immigrants to how the Trump administration treated them. Biden, of course, just got into the office. He's only been there for less than 6 months, so certainly it takes some time to change. But if we go back and look at the policies of the Obama administration, yeah, we weren't by any means really treating immigrants that well either. But continuing with Stauber's op-ed that he wrote in the Strib, he said, "It is not compassionate to encourage desperate parents to send their children on a risky journey where they could be raped or killed. It is not compassionate to ignore the influx of drugs and dangerous crime entering our communities." Now, going back to that first sentence where he says it's not compassionate to encourage desperate parents to send their children on a risky journey. Well, first up, I'm not really sure how President Joe Biden has been encouraging people to immigrate to the U.S. I think that's completely false. But really, that entire statement just misses the point. And this goes for both Democrats and Republicans when we're talking about what's happening at the border. We're only addressing the symptoms of the problem of why we're having an influx of immigrants at the border. We're not actually looking at the root causes, which is something I've talked about many times back when I did FYI Politics with Brett Johnson. And that's the fact that we've basically overthrown democratically elected governments in Central America for years and decades. And when you create that type of political instability, oftentimes you're going to get people who are in such a desperate situation, yeah, that they will send their children through country after country to try to get to a better place where they can live a better life, which oftentimes is the United States. So that's what I guess just bugs me so much whenever we hear representatives or senators going to the border and looking at the border crisis. We only end up treating the symptoms and not the actual cause of what's going on. In fact, I feel like this is probably going to be a pilgrimage we're going to see every single year from members of Congress, where especially if you're the party that doesn't hold the White House, it'll probably be a new tradition to go to the border and say, well, look, if you put us in power, we're going to solve all of these issues. Democrats did that all the time back when Trump was in the White House, where we had several Democratic representatives going down to the border and talking about the abhorrent conditions down there. By the way, they were correct. The conditions were awful down at the border. And now we're having Republicans doing the same thing, going down there and saying, look, the border's not secured whatsoever. But ultimately, we're still only talking about the symptoms and not the causes of this. And really, neither of the parties are probably going to ever do anything on immigration. Democrats, simply because a lot of them don't have the spine to actually do meaningful immigration reform or actually changing the way we open our borders. Meanwhile, for Republicans, it's of course just a wedge issue for them. If Republicans were to actually get on board and to try to solve the border issue, there goes their wedge issue that they can use. In fact, that's, of course, largely how Trump was elected, by running on that border issue. So, yeah, I just roll my eyes every time we see an elected official go down to the border and talk about how awful things are down there and how we're going to work and improve things when, for the most part, nothing's ever going to happen. Patrick, thanks to you for pointing out this story today of Stauber heading down to the U.S.-Mexico border, but I really don't see anything positive coming from this, just like I didn't really see anything positive come from other elected officials who went down there over the past few years. It's just an endless cycle. I don't know if you have any thoughts on this, being that you were someone from northern Minnesota. Yeah, just overall, not much is really going to come from this whatsoever. 952-946-6205, 952-946-6205. And one more thing I want to get to before we head into our next break. This has to do with what's happening down in Iowa, where the headline from the Associated Press is, Democrats are worried that Iowa is a lost cause. And this goes to something that I think Democrats have struggled with electorally for a while, and that's that oftentimes they like to write off certain areas and say, hell, we don't have a chance of really ever winning in this area, therefore we're not going to put in any serious candidates or any resources. And it looks like this same idea could be happening in Iowa. Here's at least some excerpts of what the AP wrote on this. So Democrats lost last year's elections for Iowa's second congressional district by the narrowest of margins. In fact, they only lost it by 6 total votes. So with that said, you would think Democrats would be fired up about trying to retake that seat in 2022, especially the candidate who lost, Rita Hart, who again only ended up not winning by 6 votes. But she has decided not to run, and so far, no other Democrat has decided to run in this race, at least so far. Again, in an election that was decided by 6 votes only back in 2020. This again from the AP. The hesitancy to jump into a district now as competitive as they come is one measure of Democrats' fatigue in a state viewed for decades as a true battleground. Even as the COVID pandemic gradually wanes and President Joe Biden's job approval remains strong, Iowa Democrats say they can feel their party receding, particularly from the industrial river towns they once claimed as bastions. And I hope that's not the case because, at least in the short term, I can definitely see Iowa staying as a very, very red state. But I think that could change over the next few years and decades, and it has everything to do with that Des Moines metropolitan area, which is growing very, very quickly. I spent parts of my previous radio life living in Iowa, and basically Des Moines is kind of like just one big giant suburb, and it's having very explosive growth, which is similar to what we're seeing in Arizona right now, where Phoenix is largely described as being just one big suburb. Arizona was red and red and red for a while, but with that explosive growth that we've seen in Phoenix into being just kind of one big suburban metropolitan area, they've turned that state purple. And I could see Iowa going through that same thing as the Des Moines area continues to grow. So while they're talking about how some of these river towns, whether it's Cedar Rapids or Cedar Falls or Davenport or others, I think that focus has to be on Des Moines. And I hope if you're a Democrat, you don't write that state off because it very well could be in play in the next few years and decades. You got to make sure you're looking at the future with these things. I oftentimes have compared Minnesota to being more similar to like a Colorado or possibly even an Illinois, where it could eventually become a state that's just dominated by one big metropolitan area that can largely keep it blue. That's obviously what we've seen in Illinois with Chicago dominating that state's politics, and the same thing happening in Colorado with Denver growing so fast that, well, the Denver metro area largely dominates Colorado politics and has made that a blue state. I see the same thing happening possibly in Minnesota over the next few years, and Iowa could be not too far behind as Des Moines continues to grow. So this would worry me if I'm a Democrat, if we have a number of these operatives saying, well, I guess Iowa's not really worth campaigning again or not campaigning in anymore. That's a mistake Dems made a lot back during the 2000s and even into the 2010s, especially during those 2010 and 2014 midterms where Democrats just decided, we're not going to compete for these seats. Or if we are going to have a candidate, it's not going to really be a serious candidate. And that's why you end up in situations where you have a lot of your representatives only in very urban areas and you're not really trying to compete in suburban and rural areas. Yeah, it's certainly a stacked playing field against you, but you still got to make the effort and feel like they could be making a mistake down in Iowa if the Dems are ready to write that state off. By the way, Iowa may no longer be the first in the nation caucus as long as we're sticking with Iowa news. Nevada legislature has just passed a law stating that they are going to be the first in the nation primary, which will set off a chain reaction of events where apparently now Iowa and New Hampshire are going to be passing their own legislation to say, now we're going to go first. So I wonder eventually if we might actually have like the primaries taking place in 2022 or 2023, simply because Iowa, New Hampshire, and Nevada keep racing themselves to try to see who can be the first in the nation primary. All right, let's take a break and come on back with more news of the day. I want to talk about the craziness that is Israeli politics right now, where apparently, we could be seeing the formation of a government that could have rotating prime ministers. Imagine that happening in the U.S. where we would have rotating presidents. We'll talk about that and more up next here on The Matt McNeil Show. Brett Johnson filling in on a Tuesday afternoon. Matt McNeil Show on a Tuesday afternoon, but no Matt today. Brett Johnson filling in. Matt hopefully will be back in the hosting chair tomorrow, as you'll be with me for the next hour and a half talking about the news of the day. And don't forget, we'll have Robert Pilot with Native Roots Radio presents I'm Awake. They'll have a live show coming up from 6 until 7 p.m. Patrick, have you been following along what's been happening in Israel right now? Not so much necessarily with the war between the Israelis and the Palestinians. I'm by no means here, and I don't think you are either, to solve the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. That's probably a conversation for like a four-hour show with people who know a lot more about that topic than you and me, but I don't know. So apparently Netanyahu is going to be ousted from power. And have you been following along on how this is exactly going to work? Because it's kind of crazy and a little ingenious.
Yeah, that is actually a very shrewd move by the opposing parties to be able to form that coalition to push him out.
Yeah, so apparently what's going to happen is that Bennett and Lapid, I'm only saying their last names because I'm going to likely struggle with pronouncing their first names, are two guys, two Israeli they're just two guys, two average ordinary guys. No, they're actually two very powerful politicians in Israel, and they are the leaders of the opposition parties in that country. Even though ideologically Bennett and Lapid come from very different places, but they are very much united in the goal of knocking out Netanyahu, who of course has been the president of Israel, or I think the prime minister, for the last decade plus. Israel has had, I think, four elections over the past, or I think it's been maybe three elections over the last 5 years. Either way, they've just been having a ton of these over the years simply because no party can get a majority, and Netanyahu, because of that, has been able to stay in power. Well, finally, these two opposition leaders, Bennett and Lapid, have decided to come together and form a coalition government in which Bennett would be the president of the country from now until September of 2023, when Lapid would take over for the remaining 2 years and 3 months of that term. That's a very shrewd move. That was a good way to describe it, Patrick. Not something you would probably see in American politics, but I'm trying to imagine how this would work, not only just in American politics, but even in Israeli or any sort of political system, where you would have two leaders say, you know what, we're going to rotate who is going to be the big dog. We're going to rotate who is going to be the head person, the big kahuna, whatever. Do you think if you're the first guy who's in office, Bennett, how excited would you really be to relinquish power in September of 2023 and then turn it over to another guy who has very different ideological views than yourself? This sounds like a very tenuous coalition, and I don't know, I'm just picturing this in my head like back when you were in kindergarten saying, well, now it's your turn to be the leader. Now it's your day to be the leader, where we're all sharing and learning lessons about all those things we did back in like kindergarten. I don't know. This whole situation just fascinates me that you can have rotating prime ministers.
Obviously, I don't understand all the nuances of the Israeli political system that allows this sort of thing to happen, but now, what happens when you get to that September of 2023? Because now I don't know what's happening to the Netanyahu's party, the Likud, if they're going to be sort of, you know, large enough that they can say, hey, we can ally with these guys and push this person out possibly if it comes to that. What if we get to that September of 2023 and the, you know, guy says, you know, oh, I think we're actually pretty good where we're at.
Yeah, Lapid could be the guy who gets the short end of the stick on this one, where if he's the guy that goes second, and yeah, you're correct. Let's say maybe there's another election held between now and then where Netanyahu's party, or maybe he gets some defections to his party, all of a sudden they get a majority and he gets to return to power. And Lapid's sitting there is the one that's that draws the short end there, and he might end up not having any power whatsoever. Yeah, it's just madness, and I would be curious to see if this can really play out, because as far as I understand it, I'm no expert on Israeli politics, but I won't even say which one is which. I think Bennett is the guy who's a little more moderate, while Lapid is, I think, center-right. I could be wrong on that, though, but either way, from what I've read, is that these two guys don't really share similar political views whatsoever, so that could be quite the transition in September of 2023. And as you said, Patrick, yeah, they could essentially just pull the rug out under Lapid and say, ah, no, you no longer get to be prime minister. Here's how I want to apply this to American politics, though, and the Democratic Party. First up, I'll say, Patrick, in the Republican Party, there's no way whatsoever they would ever agree to this sort of power-sharing agreement. I mean, could you imagine Donald Trump back in 2016 brokering some kind of deal with the RNC saying, hey, you know what, RNC, I'll be president through 2018, then we'll have Jeb take over and be president. There's no way on earth any Republican would agree to that whatsoever. In fact, even if you go to the pre-Trump days, I can't imagine that happening as well. Or let's say in 2004, I don't think you would have a situation where they would say Bush gets to be president for 2 years, and then 2 years after that, it's going to be Rick Santorum. Or I don't know, I could probably come up with a better example than Rick Santorum, but Republicans are definitely the party that's more about purging and making sure they have ideological purity. Where areas the Democrats, I could see them going towards this sort of agreement if they knew it would prevent the Republican from winning, because they are very big when it comes to presidential politics of voting for the lesser of two evils. I could easily see them brokering some kind of agreement if we're going back into a time machine and on some sort of alternate timeline where, let's say, the Dems tried to reach an agreement with moderate Republicans because for whatever reason, the DNC loves being able to tout that they have three moderate Republicans that are going to vote for the Democrat. Patrick, disagree with me if you want, but I could have totally seen that happening in the 2020 election cycle where we would have some sort of weird agreement between Democrats and, I don't know if I'd say moderate or maybe former Republicans, where perhaps the agreement would be Joe Biden gets to be president through 2022, then Mitt Romney will be president for the remainder of that term, because they would have been so nervous about, well, we got to make sure we get Trump out of office. Let's go with this coalition government. I could have very easily seen that happening if we somehow lived in a bizarro world where you could have a rotating president. Yeah, you're nodding your head on that. Yeah, I could definitely see them going along those lines. But like I said, I'd have a little tougher time picturing Republicans doing that, especially in the era of Trump. Now, as long as we got Trump and we're talking about him right now, I want to go on this, something that was written in Politico today. And this is a number of Republican operatives who are stating that Trump could lead to a lost generation of Republicans. Politico writes, in conversations with more than 20 lawmakers, ex-lawmakers, top advisors, and aides, a common concern has emerged that a host of national and statewide Republicans are either leaving office or may not choose to pursue it for fear that they can't survive politically in the current GOP. The worry is that these Republicans is that the party is being is embracing personality over policy. Well, you get the idea right there. Basically, you're having these former Republican operatives saying Trump has taken the party in such a bad direction that it's going to overall hurt the party in the long run. And of course, a lot of people who sit on the progressive side would like to nod their head and agree and say, yeah, this could end up being the end of Trump or the end of the Republicans because they're embracing Trump and there's a civil war within the party and so on and so on and so on. I completely disagree with that sentiment that there is a civil war within the Republican Party. A few minutes ago, you heard me use the word purge, and I think that more accurately describes what's happening in Republican politics right now. It's not a civil war. It's a purge. There is no civil war happening. And the way you could figure that out is look at what's happening at the grassroots level and at the state political level. Don't follow along with what's happening in Congress with Marjorie Taylor Greene or Louie Gohmert or whoever else making stupid statements or Matt Gaetz or whoever else. Pay attention to what's happening at the grassroots and the state legislative level. There is no civil war happening whatsoever. Republicans are very much united behind the Trump brand. So that's just been kind of a pet peeve of mine when I hear the Republican Party as being described as a state of civil war, when I don't think that's the case whatsoever. It's a purge. They're purging anyone from their party that doesn't like Donald Trump. If there actually was a grassroots effort to push out Trump supporters, then I might actually call it a civil war. But that's not what we're seeing right now. And I'm afraid that this purge could make the Republican Party even stronger. That's what happens when you can unite a party and have a very much fired up base. And I think you're seeing that right now with the Republican Party, where you have a big storm brewing in 2022, where if you don't just pay attention to the national level and look at the state and local, it is a very united party and something that could be a dangerous force in 2022. I think having a united party is a very tough political force, more so than just having a big tent. Looked like you wanted to chime in there, Patrick.
Yeah, I was going to say I absolutely agree with you on that. And I was going to comment you know, I don't know how many times I've heard the death of the Republican Party,
exactly.
And 2 years later they come back stronger than ever. And so I think this will be certainly no different, and certainly they're not dead by any stretch of the imagination right now with the, you know, have a, you know, 50 seats in the Senate, and they picked up some House seats in the previous election cycle. But as you were saying, it is a purge, and they are all terrified of the power of Donald Trump to motivate people to vote for his interest. They are terrified of the idea of double-crossing him, and they'll say, okay, fine, well, I'm endorsing this person for the primary because that person can beat them because they have Trump behind them.
Mm-hmm. And look at what the definition of what purge means. You're taking out the weakness of your group. Yeah, I know it's a very dark way to look at it, but that's essentially what a purge means. And from the Republican perspective, they're purging out all the weak spots of their political leaders who aren't loyal to Donald Trump. So it's far from being a civil war whatsoever. In order for all of these Republicans, at least former Republicans or former lawmakers, and again, go back and read this political story. These are all ex-lawmakers and ex-lobbyists or top advisors, people who aren't really elected or involved in local or state level politics. If you do want to start a civil war within the Republican Party and try to take it back to its roots, so to speak, you need to do that at the grassroots level. So whenever you hear these stories about, well, 20 ex-Republican lawmakers or 200 ex-Republican aides, staffers, congresspeople, so on and so on, are saying the party's moving in a bad direction, look at what's happening at the state and grassroots level to see what is actually occurring within the party. And right now with the Republicans, very much united. So have to point that out whenever I hear the term civil war and Republicans. It's not happening at all. And as you astutely pointed out, Patrick, how many times have we heard about the end of the Republican Party over the past 12 to 15 years? 2008 should have been the end of the Republican Party. They had lost the White House. Democrats had 60% of the U.S. Senate seats and a whopping 63% of U.S. House seats. That, by definition, would have been the end of Republican parties or the Republican Party. And lo and behold, in the 2010 midterm election, they took back basically all that power they lost. 2012, I remember after Obama beat Romney, how Republicans put out this autopsy report about how they're going to change and improve their party because it's an autopsy and we lost in 2012. Lo and behold, Republicans were successful in 2014 and 2016, even though they didn't follow that autopsy playbook. And I can even remember back before the 2016 election, I remember that always being the talk of how Trump is going to be the end of the Republican Party. Democrats are going to win down ballot. They're going to win the White House. They're going to win the House. They're going to win the Senate. They're going to win all these state legislatures in 2016 because Trump is on the ballot. Lo and behold, Trump one. So, yeah, be wary whenever we hear talk about the end of the Republican Party or a civil war within the Republican Party, because most of the time it's just BS. Doesn't really apply at all. 952-946-6205, 952-946-6205. We'll come on back for the last segment of Hour 1 up next here on The Matt McNeil Show. Brett Johnson filling in on your Tuesday afternoon. AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. Brett Johnson filling in for Matt McNeil on a Tuesday afternoon. Matt should be back tomorrow, but you're stuck with Patrick and I for the next hour and, 5 minutes before we got Robert Pilot with Native Roots Radio presents I'm Awake, as they'll have a live broadcast tonight from 6 until 7 p.m. So going back to this idea that Republicans are not in the midst of a civil war, they're in the midst of a purge, which very likely is going to strengthen their party. I'm just seeing this storm brewing for 2022 right now, like a hurricane out in the Atlantic that is brewing and moving towards the country in 2022, where I think Republicans are still going to have a big year, despite all the claims that they're divided right now between Trump supporters and non-Trump supporters. There's no division whatsoever. And even though we might have some crazy candidates running for office on the Republican side for both House and Senate, still afraid they're going to have success. For the Dems, you can't just rely on Republicans sounding crazy or not being united. Not going to get the job done when it comes to the 2022 election cycle. All right, a few miscellaneous stories before we wrap things up for the hour. Let's talk about Liberty University. That, of course, is the college that used to be headed by Jerry Falwell Jr., big ally of Donald Trump, of course. He was ousted as the leader of Liberty University after getting involved in some adult acts, we shall say, along with his wife and other people, I believe, including their pool boy, which just definitely fits the cliche of what a rich white person would run into with extramarital affairs. Gotta make sure the pool boy's involved. And either way, that's why Jerry Falwell Jr. was relieved of his post from Liberty University. Well, Liberty still wants to have another Falwell as the head of the college, as they're considering naming Jonathan Falwell as the university's chancellor in order to maintain the Falwell family connection, but not their political baggage. I've always thought this about Liberty University, Patrick, that they are a Division I school. Oftentimes when you see some of these more religious or political right-wing schools, they usually don't play Division I sports and don't have a very big national profile. But Liberty is different. They play Division I athletics. And the reason why I'm bringing this up is that think about the marketing tool Liberty University could have if they all of a sudden become a power in the NCAA basketball tournament. I mean, didn't they make the NCAA tournament this past year, or don't you remember off the top of your head?
I think they got knocked out in their conference finals, but the football team as well is actually building a pretty strong profile as well. So we kind of got that on both fronts, where the only two NCAA sports that bring in money and marketing, they're building a pretty good squad in both of those things.
Yeah, and if you're trying to influence young minds, so to speak, towards your political ideology, there's no better way to market yourself than having big-time Division I college sports. You get national exposure, especially with, as you said, college football and college basketball. Now, with college football, are they at the bowl level or the championship level? I think it's FBS and FCS, where the Gophers and the other big schools play in FBS, the bowl system, while the smaller ones like North Dakota State are on the FCS. Is Liberty, are they on the big stage or the smaller stage?
I think they've jumped up to the big stage, but I don't want to say what conference they're in because mm-hmm. I'm not fully certain.
Yeah, I could picture that being a very successful way to not only market the university, but get more students within the university as well. If you're seeing Liberty playing in these high-profile matchups, whether it's college football or college basketball, don't want to be the marketing guy for the school. But if I'm sitting out there and I'm running a college that wants to bring in more right-wing thinkers or mold right-wing minds for the future, no better way to do it than with a large platform of college sports. And it just seems like, too, when you see a school playing in the NCAA tournament or in a football bowl game, they have like a degree of relevance and legitimacy. And that same thing could happen with Liberty. So while it's easy to joke about them with the Falwells running the university, they're making a smart play by trying to become a sports power. All right, stick around. In hour two, we're going to update you on what's happening at the legislature. Stay with us. And we're back for hour two of the Matt McNeil Show. Brett Johnson filling in for Matt today, as he'll hopefully be returning to the hosting chair tomorrow. But Patrick and I are going to be filling in for the next hour. Got lots more to cover, including a COVID-19 update and a new way that the WHO is going to be naming COVID variants. We'll be talking about that and a interesting vaccine incentive program that they've developed in West Virginia. That's all coming up in the second half of the hour. This first half hour, though, we'll primarily be talking about the state legislature as they are approaching their June 30th deadline before we potentially have a government shutdown. But before we get to all of that, start with some non-political stuff. Patrick, are you buying the Twins' latest resurgence where they have gone 8-3 over their past 11 games and have started to make a little bit of noise climbing up in the AL Central, or are you of the belief that this is all a mirage?
Well, they have been playing some not great competition, and they still lost 2 of 3 to Kansas City this weekend, so I'm not sold.
Yeah, I'm with you, too. If only the Twins could play the Baltimore Orioles every day, they would be as good as, like, the 27 Yankees. What was that insane number you threw out last week? I think they had won 15 or 16 straight games against the Orioles.
It was 15 straight, and then they beat them yesterday in 10 innings, so now it's 16 straight.
Twins just luck out playing in that AL Central, though. I'm not buying the White Sox hanging on very much longer in that division. I mean, they'll still be a good team, but they're not going to win 100 games or anything. Still could be within striking distance if they play a little bit better as the season goes on. But as you said, losing 2 out of 3 to the Royals, I mean, come on. You kidding me? All right, let's get to the political news for today in Minnesota, and we got to talk about what's happening at the state legislature because this May 28th deadline that they had for the budget has come and passed, at least technically, but the state is not shut down yet. But we do have state layoff notices that have gone out as budget negotiations drag on. That's according to Ricardo Lopez of the Minnesota Reformer. As he writes, Minnesota state government employees received layoff notices this week, a preemptive move as state officials begin the process of planning for a potential government shutdown if political leaders fail to approve a new year budget by June 30th. Previously, the state government has shut down in 2005 and 2011. Those were the last two times we had a government shutdown. Correct me if I'm wrong, Patrick. I could have sworn we had one like in 2015. I must be remembering that incorrectly. I thought we at least had the government shut down for a couple of days because that was, I believe, just after the 2014 election cycle where Republicans took control of the state house while Governor Dayton remained governor. I thought we had a shutdown then, but maybe I'm not remembering that correctly as I jog my memory there. Do you remember any shutdown a couple of years ago?
Not recently, not since about 10 years ago with the most recent one I remember.
Yeah, they must have come close back in like 2015. I think I was even working at the station at that point as I remember following along Mike McEntee's Twitter feed to see if we were going to get a budget in that year. And I guess they did since the last shutdown was 2011, which, as you said, was 10 years ago. But when it comes to these layoff notices that were being sent out to state employees, Ricardo over at the Minnesota Reformer received a response from one of the state government employees. And as he says, it's probably the most Minnesotan response you could ever get to a layoff notice. Here is what the person wrote. Quote, I'm trying to be optimistic about the situation. It's a bit jarring to receive a notice regarding a possible layoff. I appreciate the forewarning, though. I just hope it's a non-issue and the budget gets passed. Isn't that the most Minnesota thing ever? They're basically just saying, it's fine. I could end up getting laid off. It's fine.
Probably said that if they were taking their lie outside to the barrel for the lutefisk.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So that is definitely the most Minnesotan response ever to a layoff notice. Well, hopefully they get things put together. But, you know, I do appreciate the fact that they let me know ahead of time, and it's fine. So I kind of got a kick out of that. But why could we have that government shutdown? Well, lawmakers, as I said, do have until June 30th to agree to a two-year budget. Now, last week we talked about how the legislature reached this so-called global budget agreement. And I wanted to take some time to explain at least kind of what that means. I'm still not entirely sure, so you're going to get my best take on what exactly that global agreement means and why we don't have a government shutdown yet. So I'll start off with what's being reported from MinnPost. So basically, this global agreement was a 2-page document signed by Governor Tim Walz, House Speaker Melissa Hortman, of course a DFLer, and Senate Majority Leader Paul Gazelka, a Republican. Those are the three big wigs in Minnesota state politics. And basically what was in this global budget agreement was just an overall amount of money, $52 million, that must be spent on state government. Not a dollar more, not a dollar less. There were also 10 other provisions that were included in this agreement but not listed, and we'll talk about those in just a second. So the way this works, as I understand it, is that they divided the $52 billion budget into 14 different spending bills, and then some person, or budget working groups as they're called, decide how the money is going to be spent in these 14 different spending bills, which have a set amount of money. So again, they take this $52 billion, divide it into 14 different spending bills, and in each of these 14 different sections, you have X amount of money to spend. And that's what these so-called budget working groups are deciding. And unfortunately, they're for the most part working in secrecy, so not a lot of transparency. Now, of these 14 groups or 14 spending bills, a few of them have been finalized, but many are still not put together yet. So Friday was the deadline for those budgets in various areas of government to be finalized. So technically, those 14 spending bills should have been finalized by Friday, but they weren't. Asked Friday if lawmakers had blown their May 28th deadline for budget spreadsheets, House Speaker Melissa Hortman likened it to a college student who has extra time to finish a homework assignment with a Friday deadline before a long holiday weekend because the professor won't be reading the homework until Tuesday morning. So there's some interesting logic there from Melissa Hortman saying, technically it's Friday, but no one's really going to care if we take until next week to finish these different bills. So of these 14, I think they've got like three or four of these spending bills done, but they still have to work on several more of these. So in essence, they figured out the dollar amount. It's going to be a $52 billion budget, and each of these 14 subcategories have a set amount of money that can be spent, and these so-called budget working groups are trying to figure out how that money can be spent. And a number of members of the state legislature are not happy that these budget groups are largely working in secrecy without a lot of transparency, and that's been true from both Democrats and Republicans who have largely been left in the dark, especially the more rank-and-file members. So basically, for us to reach that final budget agreement, all 14 of these different spending bills need to come together by June 30th. So that's essentially what we're working for. And there's going to be, I think, a special session sometime in the middle of June. So that's at least the whole dollars and cents part of what's happening at the legislature. But I also want to talk about these 10 other provisions that were included in this so-called global budget agreement. These are basically 10 different policy provisions that all three parties, Melissa Hortman, Tim Walz, and Paul Gazelka, all agreed to. And there's some interesting things among these 10 provisions that were included in this global agreement. So Hortman and Gazelka say they were working on stipulations that would include additional tax cuts and funding to help Minneapolis and St. Paul rebuild buildings and property that were damaged, of course, due to the unrest we saw last year after the murder of George Floyd. Interestingly, this could be why Kurt Dowd has been throwing Paul Gazelka under the bus so often over the past few days, is that Dowd and lots of other Republicans are not happy that Gazelka agreed to this $150 million that's going to be going towards Minneapolis and St. Paul to rebuild the infrastructure and property that was damaged last year. But there was another provision that caught my eye that all three parties agreed to, again, Hortman, Walz, and Gazelka, that I think is important. Not so much from a, this affects your everyday life, but could be kind of a cool little feather to have in our cap. Hortman is insistent that they are going to try to bring back the Snowbait film tax credit. Now, if you're not sure what the Snowbait tax credit is, this is how back in the 1990s, the state of Minnesota had so many big Hollywood films film their movies in Minnesota. We had this tax incentive program that encouraged all of these major Hollywood studios to shoot their movies in Minnesota. If you go back to the 90s, you probably remember that Mighty Ducks was filmed in Minnesota. So was Grumpy Old Men, Fargo, Jingle All the Way, North Country, A Prairie Home Companion. There were a whole bunch of different movies that were filmed in Minnesota back in the 90s and early 2000s. And pretty much since then, as we got rid of that snowbait tax credit, films have stopped coming to Minnesota. And Hortman would like to have that provision put back into Minnesota. I could buy that. I don't know about you, Patrick. I ended up watching a little bit of the Mighty Ducks TV series that's on the Disney Plus app. And that film or that TV series was not filmed in Minnesota, even though it takes place in Minnesota. They actually filmed that thing in like Vancouver, British Columbia. And in some of the scenes, it's absolutely obvious where the Ducks basically built their own little peewee arena that they play games in. And they have it somehow located just north of downtown Minneapolis, where if you look at the shot of the hockey rink with the supposed Minneapolis Saint or the Minneapolis skyline in the background. Yeah, it's easy to sit there and think, yeah, there's definitely no hockey rink just north of downtown Minneapolis. So I don't know. It'd be kind of fun to get some of these films back to Minnesota, especially since, I mean, come on, how can you have the Mighty Ducks movie and not have that filmed in Minnesota?
Oh, I'm definitely in favor of that. But I think even while we're saying that, I don't think people understand just how little filming actually happens on location. Most of that stuff, they're going to go back to a studio mm-hmm. in L.A. and film all the anything that happens indoors is probably going to be in L.A. or somewhere that's not local to us anyway. So it's not really, at the same time, there's not going to be a whole lot of, they're not going to film the entire movie here. It's mostly going to be on some back lot in Los Angeles.
Yeah, you're not wrong with that whatsoever. And Hortman even brings up a fairly good point, saying that at some time in the future, someone's going to tell the story of George Floyd, and that movie should be shot in Minnesota. I think she's absolutely right that at some point we are going to see a movie or biopic, like a biography film, maybe about George Floyd that, you know, might have scenes that should take place in Minnesota, since obviously he lived here during this time. But yeah, that probably be something that we would want shot in Minnesota, because, by the way, Hollywood's definitely got to make sure they cash in on the tragedy of what happened to George Floyd. But anyways, that little side note aside, that is a point that Hortman brings up as to why it's important to bring this film tax credit back to Minnesota. But here's another reason why it could be a good idea. Think about what's happening in Georgia right now with their voter restriction bills and how people are pressuring Marvel Studios and other Hollywood film studios that use Georgia as their filming location. Georgia is a major hub for filming a lot of these big budget films, including a lot of movies that you see in the Marvel Cinematic Universe. Well, I know Minnesota, we don't exactly have the best climate here, but as people continue to pressure these film studios to move out of Georgia, yeah, maybe we dangle that carrot and say, why don't you make Minnesota the new home for filming your Marvel Cinematic Universe movies? Wouldn't that be fun, Patrick, if we had like a Marvel Cinematic Universe movie where we have Iron Man and Captain America defending downtown Minneapolis from Thanos, or we get all these great Minnesota landmarks in the background. I would pay to watch that movie. To see Minneapolis get attacked by extraterrestrial villains and then having them be defended by the Avengers.
We'd put the winter in the Winter Soldier.
Oh, yeah, for sure. You would have to have this movie take place during winter. Yeah, would have put the winter in Winter Soldier. Yeah, he would certainly have to be part of that movie, but we could get a nice winter battle going. So think about that there. If you're a Marvel Studios executive, get out of Georgia, come to Minnesota. Apparently, we're going to make our state a little more friendly towards the film industry, at least if this agreement goes through at the state legislature. 952-946-6205, 952-946-6205. We'll take a break and come on back with more news here on the Matt McNeil Show. Again, Brett Johnson filling in for Matt here on this Tuesday afternoon. AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota, Brett Johnson filling in for Matt McNeil on a Tuesday afternoon. Well, if you couldn't get enough politics, we do have another election that is taking place tonight that will be seen by many national political pundits as a bellwether for 2022 and 2024. A special election tonight is taking place in New Mexico. This would be the congressional seat that was vacated by Deb Haaland, who is now serving as Joe Biden's Interior Secretary. At stake in the contest is a race between Democrats and Republicans. The Democrat is State Rep Melanie Stansbury. The Republican is State Senator Mark Moores. Now, I should point out this district in New Mexico did get won by Joe Biden by 23 points in 2020. But a reason why this could be watched nationally is that the Republican in this race, Mark Moores, has been hitting the Democrat Stansbury hard on these issues of police reform and abolishing the police. And, you know, the whole talking points that we see when we hear Republicans saying Democrats are against the police. And specifically, Stansbury is targeting, or excuse me, Moore is targeting Stansbury on the so-called BREATHE Act, which was passed by the House of Representatives earlier this year. And one of the provisions in the BREATHE Act, which I liked, would divest federal resources from incarceration and policing. That's certainly good. But the one I really liked is that it would establish a neighborhood demilitarization program that would collect and destroy military-grade equipment held by law enforcement agencies, such as armed vehicles. So you probably remember this happening a lot during the 2010s decade, where this military equipment that the military no longer had use for was getting donated to local police departments. Well, as part of this BREATHE Act that was passed by the House earlier this year, they would have this program set up where this military-grade equipment would be destroyed. Certainly a good thing. But this Republican in the race, Moores, has been hitting Stansbury on that provision and others, and it could be a kind of a bellwether of how much more action we're going to see at the congressional level on any sort of police reform whatsoever. Like I said, Biden won this district by 23 points, and it's very likely the Democrat Stansbury will be elected, being that it is a heavy blue district. But if Stansbury only wins by, let's say, 10 or 15 points, I would think Democrats are going to become even more hesitant to talk any more about police reform, which you really shouldn't be paying that much attention to anyways at the national level, because any so-called police reform is going to really come at the state and the local level. Federal government has very little to do with it. But this could be an important race for messaging, because if the Democrat Stansbury doesn't do as well as Biden did back in 2020, we'll already see that talking point put on there among members of the Democratic Party saying, hey, we can't focus anymore on the police because it's bad for us at the election box. So watch that race tonight, and especially the margin of victory. If Stansbury wins that race by 23 points or more, or at least can meet or exceed how Joe Biden did in 2020, good news for the Dems. If not, really bad news for any additional police reform at the national level. But like I said, most of that is going to be coming at the state and local level anyways. 952-946-6205, 952-946-6205. Oh, let's see. Do I want to get into a few more stories, or should we take an early break? You know what? Let's do a few more right here, because how could have I missed this one at the top of the show, Patrick? Donald Trump says he is going to be reinstated as President of the United States very soon. Former President Trump has been telling a number of people he's been in contact with that he expects he will get reinstated as president by August, according to the New York Times. Byron York with the New York Times reports that Trump has been echoing what lawyer Sidney Powell said over the weekend. So are you buying that, Patrick, that he is going to be back in office come August 1st? That is the new date right now. August 1st is when Trump is coming back.
Oh, I think he's just trying to keep his people engaged.
Yeah. Way to not have any fun with that, Patrick. No, but you're right, though. That's exactly what he's doing. Yeah, he's definitely just trying to keep his people engaged, as you said. In fact, I still think there's no way he's running in 2024. In fact, the only scenario I could see him running in 2024 is if he's in prison. I think if he's not in prison, he would be very happy playing Kingmaker in the 2024 election cycle. But if he does end up in prison, I could see him looking at a presidential race as his ticket out of prison, because there's nothing in the Constitution that says you can't run from president when you're incarcerated. And that would create the constitutional crisis if he were to win in 2024 while still being incarcerated. I don't think you could necessarily perform the job of president of the United States behind bars, so they would probably have to spring him, even though he might have time left on his sentence. So, yeah, as you said, Patrick, you astutely pointed out, yeah, it's all just bunk that he's talking about returning on August 1st or whatever the next date is. It's like those religious or conspiracy leaders that say the world is going to end on this day. Then when they're wrong, they say, no, it's actually going to end on this day. Then they're wrong again. No, it's going to end on this day. Well, that's essentially what's happening with a lot of Trump supporters right now, and Trump very wisely playing along with them to try to keep his base together, wisely playing along in kind of an evil way. But yeah, the only way I could ever see him running for president in 2024 would be if he's incarcerated. And he would only be doing it not because he wants to be president, but because it would probably be his ticket out of president. And by the way, I could very easily see him winning even if he were imprisoned. I could see him playing up the criminal justice card and getting a lot of people that you wouldn't quite expect to be in his coalition. So I don't know. Do you have any thoughts on that, Trump running in 2024 from prison?
It's interesting because, of course, we've talked about the legality of charging someone while they're president, but we haven't talked about the legalities behind putting someone's sentence, basically suspending it while they are legally elected as president. That's obviously something we have never had to talk about in the past. As Jeff Stein, Matt's, you know, usual Wednesday guest, would say, oh, Trump holding the presidency before was largely a way that he kept a lot of this stuff on pause. Mm-hmm. And now that he's out of office, a lot of those things are moving forward again. But let's say he is convicted of something and then wins the 2024 election. When he takes office on January 20th of 2025, would that mean that whatever sentence was remaining would become suspended until the conclusion of his second presidency? Is that... That's obviously something that legal scholars would have to be able to answer. I'm not one of those, but I think that would be a very plausible scenario.
Yeah, there would be so many more interesting layers to that situation. Interesting in a very dystopian sense, where if he was convicted of a federal crime, he could probably just pardon himself and be released from prison. But if he were convicted on state crimes, he wouldn't be able to pardon himself. That would be up to the governor of New York, which might be Andrew Cuomo, might be someone else, or, boy, there's a thought right there. If you're a New York Republican, you should be investing all sorts of resources into that race, because could you imagine this if Trump were to be elected from prison in 2024 on state crimes? He was in prison, and then he were to be pardoned by a Republican governor of New York. Absolute madness, but definitely a little bit of a trip down that dystopian timeline. I still find it very unlikely that Trump would ever see the inside of a prison cell. All right, we're going to take a break and come on back and talk about COVID-19 and some vaccination encouragement programs, or as I like to kind of call them, vaccination bribery programs, including one in West Virginia, which could possibly get more people vaccinated. We'll talk about that and more up next here on The Matt McNeil Show on AM 950. AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. Brett Johnson filling in for Matt McNeil on a Tuesday afternoon. Two more segments of Patrick and I before Matt will hopefully be returning to the hosting chair tomorrow. For this next segment, we are going to be talking about COVID-19 and vaccinations. And I got to start off with this vaccine hesitancy idea and why a number of people are still refusing to get their COVID vaccine. This was put out by the New York Times and the Kaiser Family Foundation, who just put out a poll that I think explains why a larger number of people have been hesitating on getting the vaccine than you might expect. A recent Kaiser Family Foundation poll found that about one-third of unvaccinated adults were unsure whether their insurance would cover the new vaccine and were concerned that they might have to pay for the shot. The concern was especially pronounced among Hispanic and Black survey respondents. I'm just reading that verbatim there from the Kaiser Family Foundation. So I don't know. I never quite thought of that idea, or I guess I did more in the peripheral, but not really as a main cause as to why people are still hesitating to get a vaccine. But that would be a pretty valid valid reason for someone being a little afraid, especially if you're someone who does come from an underserved population, or maybe you're someone who English isn't your first language for. You could be very concerned that, well, yeah, if I get this vaccine, how am I going to pay for it? Will my insurance cover it? Now, of course, the answer is that, well, you don't need to pay for the vaccine, thankfully. Guess a little bit of a taste of socialized medicine here in the United States. That's actually worked out pretty well. But yeah, I never quite thought of that as being that big of a reason. But really, when you look at it more, it shouldn't be too surprising that you would have one-third of unvaccinated adults saying the reason we're not getting vaccinated is that, well, we're not sure if we have to pay for it or if we can afford it. So I think that's an important thing to point out if when you're looking at educational campaigns to try to get people those vaccinations, just to make sure you tell them, no, it's free. You don't have to pay for it at all. But I can see that as being a very valid concern.
And now that you mention that, I don't recall seeing a lot of advertisements saying it's free. It kind of went without saying, but I think that's a good point that's brought up, that it wasn't really heavily emphasized that well.
And, you know, to expand on what you're saying, we from the Minnesota Broadcasters Association, we often get these 30 and 60 second radio spots that we air in our agreement for being a member of the Minnesota Broadcasters Association. You probably hear these ads air throughout the day, and a lot of them are COVID-19 public service announcements. And to your point, Patrick, I don't think in any of those advertisements or anything I've seen on TV, they've really addressed that point that the vaccines are free. Your insurance is not going to be billed for it. You're not going to be billed for it. So that could be an important step to take in terms of just educating people that, yes, the vaccines are free. West Virginia, though, they have a different approach to trying to get people vaccinated, as the governor of West Virginia has announced several new measures to encourage people to get shots in their arms. Let's run through a few of these, including a few incentive programs that come straight out of West Virginia. The first one, and this is actually a good idea, two full four-year scholarships to any West Virginia institution for kids ages 12 to 25. So, yeah, you could end up winning a scholarship to a West Virginia college if you get your vaccine. What else do they have as incentives? Two brand new custom outfitted trucks. They also have 25 weekend getaways to West Virginia parks. Now, I don't think these are 25 one-weekend getaways. I think one person wins 25 weekend getaways, which means you basically have your vacations covered for, what, like the next decade or so. That's not a bad deal. Also, in West Virginia's COVID vaccine incentive programs, they are providing 5 lifetime hunting and fishing licenses, 5 custom hunting rifles, and 5 custom hunting shotguns, as well as a cash prize of $1 million that they will be giving out 5 straight weeks. So there will be 5 $1 million winners. But I like this approach in West Virginia. Let's not educate people on the fact that the COVID-19 vaccines are free. If you get a vaccine, we'll give you a gun. I love that. West Virginia. That is the most West Virginia thing ever. So we'll save a life and then risk probably killing other lives by giving away guns. I don't know. That is like the ultimate do the ends justify the means question right there. Do we give people guns to get a vaccine?
Certainly the most creative of these vaccine giveaways I've seen so far. Actually, No offense to Minnesota. I think they kind of got to up their game a little bit.
We have
bit.
A weak – no, I totally agree. We have a really weak game when it comes to our vaccination incentive programs. I mean, even West Virginia, a state as small as that, is giving away five $1 million cash prizes. That's the thing that I think is really going to push people towards getting vaccinations. We saw how well that worked in Ohio where they had vaccination spike before they announced their lottery winner, and then go back down as soon as the lottery winner was announced. So that's a good idea in West Virginia with the cash prize. But as you said, in Minnesota, yeah, what are we giving away, like a free hunting and fishing license? Heck, West Virginia is giving you a hunting and fishing license for life, not just for 1 year like in Minnesota. Yeah, we got to up our game a little bit. But we're not giving away the free guns, though. Now, I can't figure out when it comes to giving away these free guns. They've listed it as 5 custom hunting rifles and 5 custom hunting shotguns. Now, does that mean each person gets one gun or does one person get 5 guns? Well, that's a question you'll have to debate if you live in West Virginia. But either way, you have a chance of winning $1 million or just getting yourself a brand new rifle or gun. So there's the approach out of West Virginia for trying to get people more vaccinated. And even if you put the guns aside, I mean, certainly the 4-year scholarship seems like a good idea. They've definitely outdone Minnesota when it comes to their vaccine incentive programs. But I'll be curious to see if this does lead to more people getting shots in their arms in West Virginia. But here in our state, very much doubt Walls would be on board with giving away hunting rifles and hunting shotguns to people. In more COVID-19 news, this goes to the World Health Organization. So, Patrick, you've probably followed along with the fact that it's almost impossible to keep track of what the names are of each of these variants, where you have B.3.14159 and B.1.24567 or whatever else they're calling these things. I think one of the numbers I gave was just pi. But either way, these variant names they give are indecipherable, so we've largely had to go with like calling them the British variant, the South African variant, variant out of India. Either way, though, it's a mess trying to figure out what the names of these variants are and what they mean. Well, the World Health Organization, they have come up with a solution. This kind of reminds me of the way that we name hurricanes, the system they've come up with. So the World Health Organization has announced that they are going to be naming variants by the Greek alphabet, where areas the British alphabet is now going to be the Alpha variant. The South African variant will be the Beta variant. By the way, that makes no sense because I think the South African variant is more potent than the British variant, so shouldn't the South African variant be Alpha instead of Beta? Anyways, they didn't ask me on that one. The Brazilian variant is going to be known now as the Gamma variant. The one out of India will be the Delta variant. One of the variants found in the United States will now be the Epsilon variant. There's another second variant out of Brazil that will have the name Zeta. Eta is going to be assigned to multiple countries. Apparently, this is some variant that was discovered in multiple places around the world, so it wasn't attributed to any one nation. The Theta variant is the former Filipino variant of COVID-19. This one is very fitting for another American variant that's out there, Iota. I don't know. I like that one, that here in the U.S., we don't give one iota about the COVID-19, so we're going to name one of our variants Iota. And then a second variant out of India is going to go with the name Kappa. So I guess they're simplifying things a little bit in trying to name these different variants, but, I mean, come on. We're the United States. How are we not the Alpha variant? We're big, powerful Americans. Shouldn't we be the Alpha variant? Or at the very least, shouldn't like the original strain of the virus be the Alpha variant? I don't know. They didn't ask me when they named these, but I just found that kind of funny that they have the Alpha and the Beta variant, even though the Beta variant is actually stronger than the Alpha variant. I think we could have a better way of naming these different things, though. What if, Patrick, we were to just name these after the people that end up spreading these variants? Like, let's say we find a guy named Randy, for instance, who ends up spreading a new version of COVID-19. Just call it the Randy variant. Or if you end up spreading a variant, that's now going to be known as the Patrick variant of COVID-19. Hey, shame people that way.
That works. Randy from St. Cloud, we apologize if you're listening right now.
I was thinking more of the Randy and Coon Rapids variant. Sorry, Randy. I had to throw that little thing in there for you. But yeah, you could have some success maybe naming these variants after the people who you can trace back as being the original spreaders of these things. Or how about this idea? What if we name the variants after, like, comic book villains or any sort of villain from literature? Like, we could have the Thanos variant of COVID, or we could have the Joker version of COVID-19, or the Luther version of COVID, or we could have a lot of fun with that, I think, naming them after, like, different villains. Or I'm a Ninja Turtles fan, so we got to have the Shredder variant out there as well. That might convey the urgency and the severity of some of these strains of COVID-19 if we were to name them after really evil comic book villains or TV villains, if we were to have like the Shredder variant or the Thanos variant or the Ultron variant. Yeah, kind of goofy, but it might encourage people, oh yeah, well that's named after Thanos. That's got to be a really serious variant. All right, and one more piece of news here on COVID-19. President Joe Biden has promised that he is going to donate $80 million of doses of vaccine to the rest of the world by the end of June. With domestic demand waning, he'll soon be able to offer far more than those $80 million of initial doses of COVID-19 vaccines. But the White House has not said yet on how it will distribute those initial 80 million doses or when they'll feel truly comfortable in supplying the rest of the world. So, Patrick, as long as we're in the mood here of coming up with solutions to problems, like I was saying, we name these COVID variants after comic book villains. How about we use a world lottery system when it comes to distributing our own vaccination or our own vaccines? Like, for instance, we could go to pick some random country and say, give us all your oil, and then we'll give you COVID-19 vaccines. Yeah, it's very pragmatic and very evil, but hey, why not go with that? There's a lot of benefits. We could potentially save a lot of wars by going into a different country and saying, if you give us your oil and natural resources, we'll give you access to 40 million doses of the Moderna vaccine. I think I just was on the path to solving world peace right there. What do you think of that idea of we just basically blackmail countries into giving us natural resources in exchange for COVID-19 vaccines? I mean, we avoid wars in that scenario. Win, win, win.
Gunboat diplomacy is over, and now it's vaccine diplomacy.
Vaccine diplomacy right there. See, I'm all about solutions. Let's just go and hold all the countries in the world hostage so we can get all of those natural resources. And if they give us their natural resources, we'll maybe give them 10 million doses of the Johnson & Johnson vaccine. We solve world peace in that process as well. All right, let's take a break and come on back for one more segment of the Matt McNeil Show. Again, Brett Johnson filling in for Matt here on this Tuesday afternoon. AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota, final segment of the Tuesday version of the Matt McNeil Show with Brett Johnson and Patrick Lilia filling in. I got no more interesting stories in my stack of papers here, so I'm just going to go to Political Wire, politicalwire.com, good website to get some short summaries of what's happening in the national political scene, and we're just going to riff on some stories for the next few minutes, Will Patrick and I. First one I got here, Nancy Pelosi rules out Biden creating a January 6th commission, as basically what Nancy Pelosi is talking about for next steps on creating a January 6th commission. She doesn't want Joe Biden to do it on his own. And apparently Pelosi's next play is possibly just doing this within the U.S. House of Representatives itself, which inherently would technically make it a partisan investigation. But I don't know. I think the Dems are overthinking this idea of needing a bipartisan commission. No matter what the results are when they come out, they're not going to be friendly towards Republicans and specifically those members that were very likely to be helping members of the mob that got into the Capitol on January 6th. I don't think it really matters if this commission is going to be technically partisan or bipartisan. Either way, Republicans are going to spin the results in their favor, saying it was a biased commission. They'll say it was a biased commission, whether it's partisan or nonpartisan. So I think if you're the Dems and you really want to have this January 6th commission, just go ahead and do it on your own. I don't think at the end of the day people are really going to care or not whether it's a technically bipartisan or partisan commission.
I hate to say it, but it's one of those issues everybody's made up their mind about already.
Yeah, exactly. Do your commission report. Get it done. Get that information out there. Republicans are going to spin it no matter who's on it, so just get it out of the way so they can figure out what happened on January 6th. All right, the other one I want to talk about is that Biden has tapped Kamala Harris to push for voting protections. I guess that's the second time Kamala Harris has been tabbed to tackle a specific issue, as President Biden vowed to ramp up efforts to fight voter suppression today as he commemorated the 100th anniversary of the massacre that ravaged a once prosperous black business district and neighborhood. Biden announced he was tapping Vice President Harris to lead the administration's work to protect voting rights and assail the Republican-led efforts to restrict voting rights in states across the country. Voter rights, of course, a tough issue for Democrats. I don't know. I just like the fact that Biden seems to be basically dumping all the tough issues onto the lap of Kamala Harris. It's kind of like if you've ever been at a job where there's always that one guy who has to do all the work that nobody else wants to do. That kind of seems to be what they're doing with Kamala Harris. Like, yeah, we got to talk about the border. We got to talk about voter rights. Have Kamala do it. I don't want to worry about this. We'll have Kamala do those issues. So I just found that kind of funny that he seems to be dumping all of these very difficult issues for the Democratic Party right into the lap of Kamala Harris. And, of course, just in time for the 2024 election cycle. By the way, if you want to solve the voting rights problems that we've been having, if you're a member of Congress and you're the Democrats, then actually get Senate Bill 1 and House, I think it's H.R. 1 passed. That's, of course, the Voting Rights Act that they are working on right now. I don't think that's the technical name of the bill, but if you pass that bill, it nullifies lots of these voter restrictions that were put in place around the country. And I think the most important thing that that bill does is it gets rid of gerrymandering and creates bipartisan redistricting commissions around the entire country. That's, I think, the most important part of that bill. There certainly are lots of other important provisions in there. But if you can't even have fair districts, really doesn't make a difference who you're able to vote for or who you are able to vote against. So I would even say just put that up, that idea of outlawing gerrymandering, just make that a single line item and take a vote on that. That's the thing I'm really watching for when it comes to voter protections, and remains to be seen whether the Dems will actually get that done. All right, that's just about all the time I got for Matt's show today. Again, it's been Brett Johnson filling in for Matt McNeil here on your Tuesday. Matt should be back with a live show tomorrow. Stay tuned. Robert Pilot and the rest of the crew have Native Roots Radio Presents I'm Awake up next.